Oh. I was thinking this week some about the kind of spiritual teachings that point to the sense of perfection that's said to be ever-present, that things as they are perfect, or the sense of completeness, sometimes a feeling of completeness, that things are complete and fine just the way they are. And this sense of things being complete or sense of things being perfect sometimes can come very powerfully on a person. And sometimes they occur in very special circumstances where it's easy to feel that way, and sometimes they come out of the blue. And so you find a lot of teachings emphasize this. In the Lotus Sutra, which is one of the central sacred scriptures of East Asian Buddhism, talks about this a little bit in the sense that kind of like we're almost as if we're already Buddhas, but we just don't know it. And the analogy, one analogy is used is that as if someone came along and sewed a wonderfully precious jewel inside your coat, and then you wandered off and became homeless and destitute and you know, a lot of struggles, but in fact you had this wonderful wealth just inside your coat and you didn't know it was there. And that's the way our spiritual life is like. We have this tremendous treasure inside of us that we don't recognize, that would make us spiritually quite rich if we just learned to take the lining out of our coat and there it is. There's another story in the same sutra of a son that comes of age. He's a son of a very wealthy man, wealthy family. And he decides to go and see the world and go off and explore and do what young men might do. And he wanders for many years, and he has a bit of hard luck and becomes homeless himself, destitute, poor, and struggles in his various wanderings around northwestern India, where the story was probably made. And he spends many, many years, decades, kind of wandering around homeless, begging, down and out. And he kind of forgets his history, forgets his past, forgets that he was his own parents and the fact that he's a son of wealthy people. And in his wanderings, at some point, he comes back to his hometown. And he's walking down the street in front of where his father's house is, mansion. And his father sees him, recognizes that his son, but also recognizes that his son, being quite destitute and down and out and kind of a little bit in desperate straits, doesn't even remember who he is himself, let alone remember that I'm his father. So his father realizes that he can't just run up to him and says, "Oh, you're my son, my long lost son. I'm so glad to see you." He feels that that now he's not such a young boy anymore. He's not going to recognize him. So he goes after him down the street and he says, "Oh, sir, I have this house right here and I need someone to shovel the horse manure from the barn, and I need someone who can do that. And you look like you're, you know, out of work and just wandering around, and maybe you have the capacity to maybe at least shovel shit. And you know, I'll pay you a little bit of money if you want to come for the day and shovel." And so the son says, "Yeah, I can do that," and he's happy to have a little job. And so he shovels the manure for the day. And after the day, the father's says to him, "Well, you did a really good job here. You know, actually, I could use someone to work in the stables on a regular basis." And the son, who doesn't have a very high opinion of himself, thinks, "Well, at least I could, you know, shove from manure, and maybe it's nice to have the stability here." And so he does that, and he does a pretty good job shoveling manure in the stable. And after a while, his father says, actually, "You do this really well, the shoveling. What I really need now is someone to work in the garden. I need a gardener, and I wonder how you'd be at doing that." And so the son learns to garden and eventually learns to take over the garden crew and over many years becomes a great gardener. And after many years the father says, actually, "You're doing a really great job here. You're managing this crew. I need someone to manage the whole crew and the estate and all the servants and people. And maybe you can become the foreman of the servants or whatever." And so he does that. Then he becomes a trusted accountant for the father and takes care of all his money. And then after many, many years, It's as if the son is—it's as if the son has become his son because they're so close. He's slowly kind of grown in trust and confidence and ability and all that. And then the father says, "Oh, and by the way, you are my son, but you weren't in a good enough shape to see that 20 years ago. So we had to do this kind of slow approach, gradual approach, to before you're ready to hear this wonderful teaching that you actually are my son and you're going to inherit all this wonderful stuff here." So the Lotus Sutra says that we're like that, that it's very hard for us to believe in our own sense of worth, our own sense of well-being, our own preciousness, that we all are the sons of the Buddha or daughters of the Buddha, we all are perfect or in some spiritual way. And so maybe, perhaps it takes years of spiritual practice to kind of first, in the first years of your practice, you're mostly shoveling manure. And then you kind of, you know, get into the garden for a while, and it's kind of nice, and then into the house for a while, and it's really nice. And after a while, it kind of dawns on you, maybe it is true. Something was true all along. So these kinds of teachings that we're already perfect just the way we are, or that things are complete just the way they are, nothing more is needed, certainly goes against the common sense, seemingly obvious perception that things are not okay. That things should be improved on, that there's too much unfinished business in our lives, or there's too much tragedy going on, or too much loss, or people die too soon, or and we're left without, you know, the benefit of their love. Or there's a lot of things, a lot of loss. You know, how can things be complete? How can you say this, you know, when my husband is in Stanford Hospital fighting for his life? How can you say things are complete and perfect in this kind of world? As long as the teachings on completeness, the completeness of the present, are just teachings, spiritual teachings from whatever tradition you're connected to, it's easy to kind of dismiss them. You can say maybe get out of my way. I'm too busy to be told there's nothing that is so important that requires me to be busy. I'm too busy to listen to the message that you don't need to be busy. I'm distracted from my distractions by my distractions. We're so caught up in the world we live. But it's easy to dismiss the kind of teachings, you know, as they go against the common sense of how things are. They go against the momentum and impulse, the drive, the compulsion which many people live. That, you know, in order to, we're seeking for completeness, seeking for things, trying to accomplish things. And as long as, but people also, it isn't just teachings. People have the experience of things being complete in the moment. And as long as those experiences are happening to other people, then maybe it's also easy to dismiss it. You know, those people, you know, they're kind of myopic, they're idealists, you know, and they don't really connect it to the real world. And I don't want to be that kind of airy-fairy kind of person. Or that person doesn't have this kind of responsibilities that I have, or the history, or difficulties and problems that I have, and what their experience is like, it doesn't really relate to me. However, when the feeling of completeness occurs in yourself, for oneself, then maybe it's not so easy to dismiss it, because it's not out there anymore. And it might happen sometime. Maybe sometimes it happens once or twice in childhood, or sometimes it happens in adulthood in various circumstances. And it might happen in a context where it seems, okay, it's okay in this context, but we don't kind of then universalize that as it being a strategy or understanding, a perception for how we live our lives. But when it happens to ourselves, some feeling of things are perfect, or I feel complete, or things are complete right now, or things are just as they should be, how do we understand that? What's that? What kind of meaning do we use to understand that kind of experience? What kind of value do we put both on the experience and the memory of having that experience? What kind of context do we put it in? So, I had an experience this week that was quite poignant, experience of feeling quite complete in the moment, and I was sitting in a friend's garden. She had a beautiful little garden. She tended to it for many years. And we were sitting outside in the garden chairs under the in the shade, and I had a little bit of stuff, a little water to drink, and a little coffee cake, and we were sitting there, and it was quite pleasant, the temperature. It was quite beautiful. It was in the morning, around 9 o'clock, and so it was kind of stillness. Even though you could hear the traffic in the distance, the garden itself had this wonderful quality of stillness, and the light was kind of filtering through the redwood tree and other trees, and at some point I was just looking out at the garden, and there was kind of like an opening above the lawn where light was kind of filtering through, and you could see all these wonderful little insects or flies or something flying, just hovering there. You know, it's not hardly, almost still in the air, just hovering there, and then they dash off for a while and come back in the light. And I just sat there, and things felt complete, wonderful, just perfect. I felt no need to be anywhere else or do anything else or be anything else or say anything special to this woman that I was sitting with. Just it was there. But what's interesting, and what gave my idea for giving this talk, was the context in which I was feeling a sense of completeness. The day before, I had been at the funeral of the 29-year-old son of the woman who I was visiting. So I stopped by in the morning to see how she was after being at her funeral. At the funeral of her son, and so that, you know, she was in mourning and grief, and so that gave a certain kind of that contrast of me feeling a sense of completeness against her tremendous loss. Certainly gave a kind of, you know, a very different context, at least for what is going on here with this feeling of completeness that I was feeling, and I was feeling actually quite. It wasn't that I was ignoring her or ignoring what had happened, the funeral the day before and the death of her son. It was very present for me, that experience. The funeral was quite a powerful event. And as those of you maybe have been to funerals, you know, certainly the powerful sense of loss, the grief, the sense of absence, and also occasionally a sense of various ways, a great sense of fullness that can happen at funerals, maybe a painful kind of fullness. But you know, one fullness was sometimes when different people speak, you get all these different angles of the person who's died, and you sense you get a bigger picture of the person than maybe you kind of knew yourself, because you saw the person always in one context, and you hear all the different contexts of their lives, and wow, I didn't know that person had so many different angles and so much richness in that person, sense of fullness of that. And, certainly the fullness of the feelings and emotions that can come, which can be quite wide-ranging at a funeral, both the grief and the sadness, but also the love and remembering back at the joy, the good times, the bad times, and all kinds of things. Funerals can add a sense of immediacy to our lived life, the vibrancy of what it is to be alive now, the contrast of the loss that's there versus the fact that we're still alive, and what is it to be alive? And certainly being there at the funeral, at the cemetery, on a sunny Tuesday afternoon and blue skies up in Colma, was, you know, it's had a quality of presence, of immediacy, of just being there that sometimes it's not so easily tapped into in a busy life. It often brings up questions like, what is it to die? What is death? What is it to live? What is living and dying? What is it to live? I'm quite fond, I've told this before, of old photographs. Preferably ones that are at least maybe 100 years old. And of people. And there's something about, for a long time, I gravitated toward these old photographs. I would stop, if they were on walls someplace, I'd stop and look at them, or books, I would kind of go through them and look at them. And it slowly dawned on me, the reason I was attracted to these old photographs was that these are people who are long dead. And I would look at their faces and look at their eyes, and sometimes be kind of blurry, you wouldn't see much, but sometimes the pictures were quite sharp, and you would see their expression was there, or their kind of expression in their face, some expression of all kinds of things, sometimes of hope, of joy, sometimes playfulness, or sometimes of kind of a little bit of arrogance right there. You see this little arrogant kind of, you know, some young man kind of arrogant, and you know, he's long dead. You know, what's the arrogance about? And sometimes sadness and exhaustion and all kinds of expressions in the face. And sometimes the eyes themselves have a kind of vibrancy and aliveness to them, and sometimes a dullness. But sometimes almost as if, you know, the life of that person, it was captured for a moment. And that moment of life for that person is no longer here. It was 100 years ago or more. And part of the reason that I felt attracted to these photographs was not so much the thinking back into the past, but it was, for me, a very powerful reminder that for me to be alive and present for this moment of my life, that was their moment of being conscious. That was their moment to be alive and present for the life they're given. Everyone who's born is given a certain amount of time, or given, or has a certain amount of time to be present for their lived life, for to be conscious, to be here. And whether it's 100 years ago or 200 years or 1,000 years ago, and regardless of what the technology is or the benefits or the medical advancements or whatever the wonderful things that we have now, certain things don't change over time. And the ability to be conscious, to be present, to be aware of one's thoughts and feelings are basically the same over the centuries. And that was their moment where they had the opportunity to do that, to live their lived lives. And this is my moment, to live my lived life. And so, just like in funerals, sometimes looking at that old funeral, the old photographs, brings a kind of vibrancy to being present here and now. When the funeral was over, up in Colma, I've never actually been to the cemeteries at Colma before, so it was kind of a new experience for me. They're kind of big, vast areas of just stone after stone after stone, gravestone after gravestone. And so wandering around there, looking at the different gravestones, or standing there, you know, with a funeral with a casket going down into the ground and being covered, and looking around and seeing all the other stones that all the other people buried over the years that they've been there at Colma. A sense of, you know, each of those stones, gravestones, marks one human's life. And there's a certain level of universal commonality in people's lives that are somehow, for me, was symbolized in each of those gravestones. Each of those persons who was there at some point was born, and was born to a mother, and may perhaps, for some of them, a lot of them perhaps, there was a lot of joy early times in their birth. And then all those people died, obviously, and probably there was a level of grief from people who knew them. And that person's life was surrounded by other people who at times felt joy and delight in their presence, and sometimes felt loss and sadness. That person probably had struggles and joys of all kinds. Not all births are happy producing. Not all deaths are sad producing. It's a wide range of way that, you know, human lives are experienced. My friend Barbara Gates is doing research in her neighborhood to write a book. She's writing a book over in Berkeley. And she was studying history of her house. And she went through the death certificates of the people who first built and lived in the house that she lives in now. And the first woman to live in the house, who lived there for many years, she found her death certificate. And I'm not sure exactly how old she was when she died. But the medical examiners wrote in the cause of her death. Wrote down the cause of her death was exhaustion. That's quite powerful. You know, someone who died 100 years ago. And that was one of the causes of death of 100 years ago. So all these feelings, all this sense of vibrancy and poignancy of Tuesday, of the funeral and the loss. So I was sitting there with a grieving mother, feeling a kind of completeness of the moment. But it certainly seems strange, since the present, in the very present, was also a sad absence of a loved one, never to be seen again. Was it okay for me to feel complete, as if things did not need to be any different? Was it ethical, given the context, for me to feel that way? Was it okay to feel that way? One more, a bit more about the context for sitting in the garden, that sense of completeness. The feeling of completeness was not automatic for me, or spontaneous. In fact, it arose only when I had recognized an impulse inside of me to be elsewhere, to get on with the important activities of my day. I'd been sitting there for some time, and certainly it seemed like, you know, I'd been there certainly the appropriate length of time, whatever that is. And so inside of me was, okay, let's get on with things, you know, important things to do, right? And so I felt this kind of just contraction inside of me, this kind of compulsive drive and upwelling of energy and kind of a little bit of restlessness that arose a little bit, very little, but it was certainly there, and I recognized it and arose. And much of spiritual practice, I believe, mindfulness practice, is learning to recognize these kinds of impulses, these little contractions, little forces of restlessness and compulsion, drivenness that arises for us. And then learning not to believe it necessarily, learning how not to be driven or enslaved, controlled by these kind of compulsive drives. And they take many different forms. You know, the grass is greener somewhere else kind of drive. Okay, this is what's happening now is not, you know, if I stay here, I'm missing something. I have to go somewhere else where I can get something, you know, more important. I was embarrassed a number of years ago where I realized that many years ago, I went to parties. And no matter who I was standing and talking to, I always thought there was someone else I was supposed to be talking to, that was better to be talking to, more interesting to be talking to. And so I could never be kind of settled. I'd always be a little restless talking to whoever it was. It doesn't matter, you know. It's like, and then I'd go find someone else, and then maybe I'm missing something else somewhere else. And it was, you know, kind of horrible. I don't know if they noticed, but it's kind of horrible. I imagine it's horrible, you know, way of being with someone where you feel like, you know, there's something more interesting somewhere else. You know, I'm missing out on something unless I, you know, do something. The sense of missing out is a very common one for many people. There's some people, it takes the impulse of if only, the idea is if only things were a certain way, and then, you know, everything would be okay. And so it keeps us going, the compulsion, searching and getting and making something to happen different. Our plans, you know, our wonderful ability to plan. Seems like maybe our society has produced better planners than any society in the history of the world. It seems, you know, it's like epidemic, the planning mind in our culture. And then what happens, planning is fine, it can be innocent in itself, but then we feel compelled to act on those plans and follow through on them. And planning is always about something in the future. And so the sense of kind of like, we're kind of leaning ahead of ourselves into the future, not able to recognize any sense of completeness or well-being or ease in the present moment, because the planning kind of pushes us forward. The planning also can lead to not only inability to be present, but also frustration to the present moment, because the present moment is getting in the way of my plans. And so the frustration can be quite physical, because the energy in the body kind of is ready to burst forward, go forward, and the situation keeps us from going forward. And so this, you know, pull-push kind of situation arises, can be very painful within us. Sometimes it's an impulse to get away, a compulsion, let's get away from here, I can't stand it here, I don't want to be here, this is not comfortable, and is what keeps us from really being present and full. So a lot of mindfulness practice is learning to recognize these drives, what drives us, what compels us, the compulsions that are often pushing us beyond the present situation, the present moment, the lived moment as it is right now. So I was sitting in this garden, and this impulse to move on arose. However, I was not only did I notice that, but I was helped by remembering that what I was going to do, the important thing that I was going to go do, was that day, Wednesday, I had dedicated to doing a self-retreat. I was going to go and meditate for the day. I had a really important thing to do. I was really important to get to the place, my meditation place, so I can really be in the present moment, accept the present moment as it is. So I was helped by this realization, because then it just seemed absurd. What, you know, you know, get away from here so I can really be present in some other place. However, so I recognize the absurdity of sacrificing now for a future now. But I think many of us, it takes a sense of real power or authority or something to get our attention enough that it feels like it's okay to really be present for life as it is. And I think some of the grandeur of religious institutions sometimes is we human beings need a lot of convincing. And you need something which is a really powerful authority figure to say it's okay to just be present and notice the skies. And so funerals are, you know, that kind of way. But sometimes, but you know, you go into great cathedrals and it's so still and quiet, and it's kind of the vibrancy of the present moment can come alive for you, and you can feel like it's okay to relax and just be there for that. And put us, you know, we enter these big quiet cathedrals or whatever and go up into the high Sierras, and you know, and we kind of, okay, it's okay to put everything else behind, just be present. We don't feel like we have the justification for doing it in the normal, ordinary, mundane activities of our daily life. So it's kind of like the story of that son, you know, who needed a lot of convincing that before he could be told, or a lot of preparation before he was told that he was the son of his father. So we need a certain level of preparation or context or a certain thing to realize the preciousness, the treasure of the present, the vibrancy of lived life in the moment. So I was able to let go of that impulse. There's also the desire inside of me, my wish, to be present for my grieving friend. And so not only did I saw the absurdity of my impulse, so I could let go of it, but also I genuinely wanted to be there present for my friend and do what I could to help. But that wish to be present for my friend could easily led to all kinds of other impulses inside of me that would have kept me, in a sense, from really kept some sense of completeness or well-being in the present moment. I could have been completely preoccupied about saying the right thing. You know, what do you say to someone who's grieving the loss of her only child? Sometimes a kind of contraction, perhaps, of taking responsibility for my friend's state of mind, well-being, and oh, I have to say something or do something or you know, whatever. And that kind of preoccupation and anxiety would have also prevented the sense of well-being and completeness from being there. So I let go of my impulses. I let go of these compulsions. And I felt a completeness that included the sense of loss that was the reason for us being together, the sadness of the time, the weight of that moment. My wish for my friend's well-being, and also included the wish for my friend's well-being. What was absent was my own contraction, resistance, clinging, drivenness for those moments where I sat there just looking out of the garden. When I let go of all the impulses to get away, to fix, to defend, to impress, to avoid, to get things, to acquire, to be someone, then there was a sense of being with things as they are. It was a sense of peace, a sense of completeness, a sense of perfection. Now, it's easy to assign a label or meaning to this sense of peace or well-being as being, this is experience of being complete. That's kind of the theme of this talk, sense of being complete in the moment. But that's an interpretation. It's an assigning of an understanding to that moment. Because it feels kind of complete. It feels kind of perfect, feeling like nothing else is needed. So we say that things are complete. But to really do it well, this kind of even the sense of things being complete has to be let go of. You can't carry around this interpretation, this idea that things are complete. It's not the idea of completion which is important. What's important is the letting go that happened. It's not so much about arriving in some ideal state or some appropriate way of being, some wonderful spiritual state of being or whatever in the moment. The point is to let go. Let go of all the things that pulls us away, all the drivenness and anxiety and fears. The point is to let go. And what is it that's left when we are not driven by compulsion, by desire, by fear and aversion? What is it that's left when we are brave enough to let go of our illusions? When we let go of all the ideas of what we need, are we brave enough to let go of all the ideas of what we need, what needs to happen? All the ideas of who we are or who we need to be. Brave enough to let go of all the ideas of who we are based on our memory of what happened to us in the past. Brave enough to let go of all the worrying about others or worrying about what others will think about us. That takes a lot of bravery. Talk about courage. Let go of what we think other people are thinking about us. Let go of all the conclusions we've made about life. There's a lot of very subtle attitudes about life that we carry with us that are kind of like little compulsions, little drivenness, little ideas that are in the background, kind of like an operating system in their mind that we've somehow acquired over a lifetime of experience, or one particular powerful experience that somehow formed us, that the world is not safe, people are not safe, I have to protect myself, or this is a world where everyone has to fight for themselves, and you know, all kinds of little attitudes about all kinds of things we carry with us, kind of operating attitudes, which really get in the way of any possibility of deep peace and deep sense of completeness, because they never let us rest. So what happens when we simply let go? It isn't so much that we need to have a sense of completeness. And in fact, maybe completeness is not a very good word for the experience I had in the garden, because it was obvious it wasn't complete. There was a powerful sense of absence, or there was, you know, but things didn't have to be any different. Or to say it a little bit more appropriately and more accurately, in that moment of well-being, I don't know if well-being is the right word, because I was certainly feeling sad. Part of it, kind of heavy in the moment. So it's almost better not to characterize what is left when we let go. To have some idea of who we're supposed to be, what it's supposed to look like, how we're supposed to be feeling. So we can measure the experience. Oh, that's it. I finally got it. I think there was a certain groups and spiritual groups in America, but it was all about getting it, right? Getting it. I got it. Or Buddhism, you know, I get the enlightenment. Is this the enlightenment we're chasing after? Is this what we're supposed to do? Is this it? Finally got it? I think it's not so useful to look at it. I'd look for the solution, the answer. To look for a state. But rather, to be in a constant state of willing to discover. What is it? What's left when we let go of all the compulsions? And all the needs to be different, all the drives and anxieties. So that in Buddhist spirituality, the point is not an it. The point is the letting go. The letting go. And then letting what's left bubble up and be what it is. What is left? It would be easy to say, love, peace, inability to respond to life out of our native, innate intelligence, as opposed to our anxious intelligence, But to call it those things, to call it love and peace, maybe it's dangerous because it can make it into another it. But rather, in mindfulness practice, we try to be brave enough and mindful enough, even in the most mundane activities of our life, to notice our compulsions and to let go, and let go, and let go. And in the letting go, to appreciate the very vibrancy of our lived life at this very moment. Complete, perfect, as it is. So that was my thoughts. So, maybe it's complete enough. Yes, please. Sometimes rituals can be very helpful because of, sometimes our clinging, our holding on, is happening at almost subconscious levels within us in our psyche, and so even though you might understand very well principles of letting go and how to let go of certain things, parts of the psyche doesn't necessarily know how to do it. And so the language of the psyche sometimes is ritual. And so occasionally, I meet someone where really a ritual is what is called for, because you reach into that part of the psyche which is quiet. And then it's really a matter of figuring out what's appropriate for each person. Becoming a monastic, a monk or a nun, is a ritual letting go. Shaving your head and living a renunciation life, it's a powerful ritual, and for some people that's what it takes, is to do that kind of archetypical act of renouncing the world and becoming monastic. There are smaller, there's all kinds of smaller things to do. The Buddhist funeral ceremonies often has a very important element of letting go as part of it. Part of the preparation of helping someone die is a preparation of helping people let go, or helping the loved ones who are remaining, learning how they can let go. Sometimes you get the sense of someone hanging on there to their life because what they need to hear is that the loved ones who are left, that it's okay with them that they die. And so they need to be, it's okay. So, or at funerals, sometimes there's kind of an expression of, in Buddhist funerals, occasionally a sense, we're letting you go now. So that helps the psyche and maybe the person who died. For some Buddhists, there's daily rituals of having an altar and making offerings to the altar, and that making offerings and bowing to an altar is for some people acts of letting go. To actually have to put your hands together and lower your head and bow all the way down to the floor, for some people, you have to let go of a lot psychically, kind of almost unconsciously, pride, arrogance, all kinds of things. In that act of kind of humility, of bowing down. And to do that on a regular basis is quite powerful for both the heart and the psyche inside. Another powerful practice of letting go that the Buddhist tradition have is confession. Vipassana Buddhism doesn't talk about that a lot, but much of Buddhism confession is part of the scene. And confession is sometimes necessary to confess or to acknowledge or to state truthfully what's happened in order to be able to let go of something about what's happened. And so confession is, maybe the word confession maybe has kind of too much of a Catholic flavor for us to feel comfortable with it for some of us, but I don't know exactly what the Buddhist word is, but it's sometimes translated into English as confession. Okay, so May each of you appreciate each vibrant moment of life while you have it, rather than someone 100 years looking at your photograph and wondering, was that person present for their moments? So may you all appreciate the life you have. Thank you.